You're listening to Psych Up on the Kasozo Radio Network. And now your host, psychologist and author, Dr. Suzanne Phillips.
Hi, I'm Dr. Suzanne Phillips. Welcome to Psych Up. On this show, which can be heard on WMIQ Talk Radio, online as Kasozo Radio, and as a podcast on iTunes, we consider a broad range of topics that may impact your life psychologically and in many interrelated ways. We live in a high-tech age of access to almost anything, including an instant and affordable stream of explicit sexual content and willing sexual partners. Today we're going to consider a serious problem, cybersex addiction. Our guest is a leading expert on this problem. Robert Weiss is a psychotherapist, international speaker, the author of many books, including Untangling the Web, Sex, Porn, and Fantasy Obsession in the Internet Age, Closer Together, Further Apart, and his latest book, Always Turned On, Sexual Addiction in the Digital Age. Rob Weiss, welcome back to Psych Up.
It's a pleasure.
This is such an interesting and perhaps confusing topic, but it's one that we are so interested in addressing. You know, everything you read says that with this access, millions of people are downloading sexual content. They're visiting sexual sites. What makes sex an addiction?
You know, Sue, I think that's a really good question because a lot of people really struggle with this idea of behavioral addictions. You know, I think that our culture has kind of gotten a handle on the idea that people can be addicted to a substance, that you can be addicted to alcohol or heroin. I think far too many of us have struggled with nicotine over the years. So, you know, the idea that someone can put a substance into their body and then they can then become adapted to it and then becomes a form of coping and then they come to rely on it. And then if they try to get off it, it just, you know, they can't. That's a familiar scenario for people around drugs and alcohol, but they really, I think our culture doesn't really get binge eating or even compulsive gambling or
compulsive shopping. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Or sex addiction. I mean, there's seems to be a misunderstanding or a lack of understanding of how that works. And so maybe it's worth just talking a bit about the behavioral addictions and how you really can be addicted to a behavior.
I think that's a good idea. Would you say, what I've always thought over the years, and I wonder what you think about this, is that for something to become addictive, you talk about the fact that those people who become addictive really are trying to escape from intolerable feelings, life events they can't deal with or regulate. And for me, there has to be something transformative that happens when someone gambles, when somebody is getting aroused from porn. There has to be a transformation that for a short time they have some temporary relief from that negative feeling. Do you think of it in that way, Rob?
You know, Sue, here is the thing about behavioral addictions is that, you know, first of all, people say, oh, can anything be an addiction? And that's really just a misunderstanding. In order for something to be an addiction, it has to bring a great amount of pleasure or satiation. In other words, it has to fill you up to the point where you're just completely full of that experience or that substance, like ice cream, for example, or where it just fascinates you to the point that it's so exciting, even the idea of it, that everything else goes out of your head. And the reason that people pursue addiction, you know, maybe this is the best way of putting it. When I work with a sex addict or a porn addict, they can spend, you know, I've worked with sex addicts who spent a week planning their sexual act and 10 minutes having it. You know, I've worked with a guy who will save money for a month so that he can go out and get high, you know. And my thought about that, and I think this sort of explains the behavioral addictions, is that we only really have one pleasure center in our brain, you know, and it involves a release of dopamine, which is a hormone that gives us pleasure, and it drives us as human beings on this earth to survive. It really, pleasure drives us toward survival. So if you don't have sex, our race doesn't make it. You know, if you don't eat, you don't make it. If we don't join in community, which is pleasurable, or exercise or join in productive activities that are either recreational or creative, we don't get that same feeling of, that felt good. everything that feels good to us has to do with the release of dopamine. So all of us gravitate toward pleasurable experiences like eating sexuality or for some of us gaming, or some of us enjoy writing or working. All of these things are pleasurable because they're naturally occurring functions and they make us feel good. I think the question you're asking is, why is it for some people that they go gamble a couple of times, or they go out there and start having some kind of anonymous sex or porn use, and all of a sudden they find themselves doing it over and over again to the point where they're really destroying their lives?
Right. Where
someone else says, oh, well, the gambling was fun, or you know, I enjoyed watching that, going to that bachelor party, but that's not my thing. You know, why do some people get stuck?
Right. That's
and
the
really,
question.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. The answer to that is simply that for some people, the pursuit of pleasure and being completely satiated is a way to distract themselves from the pain of life. And there are, you know, we have a pretty consistent ratio of people who are addicted, whether it's substances or behaviors, somewhere between 8 to 12% of the population shows up with problems with drugs, alcohol, gaming, gambling, sexual acting out, that kind of thing. And so we know that there's a fairly constant percentage across at least U.S. Americans who, unlike their brother, their sister, their friend, they don't stop at one or two drinks. They don't stop at spending $100 once a year at the casino. They don't stop at going to the bachelor party with friends and saying, well, that was fun, but, you know, I'm not going back. For them, there's a secondary gain. In other words, there's something more than just having the fun of that, you know, Thanksgiving meal, or the fun of that experience I was saying blackjack table. I was thinking of those machines. They're not, you used to pull the handle on them, slot machines, right? So for people who have these issues, it's not just about having the fun of the experience. They also quickly learn that as long as they're in those experiences or seeking them out, which means high-intensity sex, gaming, gambling, and spending, that they are really kind of spaced out. You know, they're not really present, and that is really the goal, is to pleasurably space out, if you will, or in my language, our language, dissociate, or kind of disappear into the idea of pleasure, how great it's going to be to get to those drugs, how exciting it's going to be to get a hold of those prostitutes, how wonderful it's going to be when I get to the casino and I win all this money. And we actually see that there are brain or neurobiological impairments in people who have these kinds of addictions. And we see it in the area of the brain that involves anticipatory pleasure. So it's the anticipation of pleasure, the idea of how great this thing is going to be when I get to go do it, that leaves people who have these kinds of addictions getting lost in the excitement of what they're about to go do. And they can lose themselves in that for long periods of time.
Okay, so I have to ask you the question, I'll be devil's advocate for a moment, in that you even sort of suggest in the book that when you look at studies, I think it was a Stanford study of a percentage of people, let's say 9,000 people, who are identified as addicted to the online sex, the porn, the virtual partner, whatever. Of that group, only a very small percentage had this addiction before. So the question becomes, is there something, Rob, about cyber sex? That is there something about technology? Is there something about the endless pictures, whatever happens that we can now do online, that drives sex addiction, in this case, cyber sex addiction, in a way that we never saw it before?
Yeah, so that's another also really important issue related to why we're seeing more people with addictive and compulsive sexual behavior. It's simply because online porn and online sexual access is, well, let me put it in two different ways. Number one, if I wanted to access some pornography in 1985, you know, I had to get in my car, I had to get dressed, I had to go to that icky place under the bridge, you know, I had to hope nobody saw me in the parking lot, grab a magazine and two videos, put them in a brown paper bag, and then I had to race out of there, you know, take them home, enjoy them if I wanted to, and then half the time I had to return the videos because they were expensive and they were rented. And what do I have to do to look at porn now? I just say to my phone, hey, Siri, where's the porn?
Right.
And so, you know, and if you think about, I'll give you another example. If I was visiting Chicago on business and I decided that I wanted to go hire a prostitute, you know, back in the day, pre-internet, I would have had to give $20 to a bellboy or a cabbie, ask where the red light district is, risk getting arrested or getting in trouble, mm-hmm. and I might not even find what I'm looking for. And now I just say, Siri, where are the hookers? And my phone can geolocate a half a mile away, a mile away, 2 miles away, escort services with maps and addresses and phone numbers.
Right.
So you have to take into account that the whole idea of what we call friction or the things that would slow down mm-hmm. someone from making a decision is all gone now. Because the decision to look at porn, the decision to hook up online, the decision to hire somebody for sex, that takes about 5 seconds between the time you decide you want to start looking and the time you are looking.
And so then we've taken the risk out, the face-to-face, the embarrassment, the possible aggravation. We've taken a lot of that off the table now.
Well, and you have a guarantee because let's face it. So, I mean, you don't know me very well, but, you know, if I want, I mean, personally, but you know me as a professional, but I'll tell you what, if I wanted to go get laid and I went down to a bar in 1975 or 1985 or 1990 and I put on a bad shirt and some cheap cologne and hoped I got lucky, I might and I might not.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my business associates would see me down there looking for someone and they know I'm married. You know, who knows? But today with Grindr and Tinder and Ashley Madison and all of the hookup apps, which, you know, your listenership may not be familiar with, I can literally geolocate 15 people looking for sex within half a mile. And I never have to leave my house or hotel room. So there's a guarantee that I'm going to get what I want at some point if I work hard enough at it. And that was just simply not true before.
Okay.
So so really quickly, we look at this combination of access, affordability, and anonymity. And we call that the AAA engine of online sexuality. And that's really what drives the addictive quality.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know, would you say that women are as vulnerable to sex addiction, particularly cyber sex addiction, as men? What would you say, Rob?
Well, I'm very proud and honored to have opened the only two treatment centers right now that exist for women who have these kinds of compulsive sexual issues or who repeatedly enter abusive relationships. So real residential programs that look at intimacy and sexuality for women who are really struggling with it. And two things are happening simultaneously. One is that women are having much more comfortable access to very explicit sexual images and sexual experiences. You know, it's one thing for me to go down to an adult bookstore in 1988 and get some porn. It was quite another thing for a 22 or a 25-year-old girl or woman to walk into that bookstore. I mean, how humiliating was that? Let's not forget what our culture says about women who have a lot of sex.
Right.
Like men who have a lot of sex are players and studs, and women who have a lot of sex we say not such nice words about. So it's always been harder for women to access sexual content and sexual experience without running up against the cultural values that are placed on women who want to have a lot of sex. Well, now, if you didn't notice the sales of 50 Shades of Grey a year and a half ago or how many people went to see the movie, now we're living in a new world where a woman doesn't have to walk into a Barnes & Noble and buy a softcore porn book and feel uncomfortable at the cash register. You know, she can just download her ebook, which I guarantee you is what drove the sales of that particular softcore book for women. And so women have much easier time accessing porn and accessing sexual content and sexual partners. Again, a woman doesn't have to go down to the bar. She doesn't have to go, you know, stand there and wait for someone to pick her up. She doesn't have to walk into that porn store or walk, you know, she has freedom to find sexual context and experience without fear of being judged.
You know, one thing you had in the book that really rang true with the many, many women over these years that I've worked in is this. They don't necessarily define themselves as having many of them, a sexual addiction, because they're not necessarily, yes, they all read 50 Shades, and everybody read 50 Shades, okay. But the ones who you call the problems with the having a problem, they do look a little different than the men, and they are the people who I've worked with who have suffered, who have been in endless relationships, always with wrong people. Very rarely do the relationships work. It's always a string of people. It's a willing to be sexual, often with people they do not know, right, with the hope that this is Mr. Perfect. And in an ever-ending search, really, for themselves on some level, they don't stop now hooking up online. And they always do it sort of in the sense of a relationship. Yeah. But actually, it's that same desperate drive for the fix.
Well, I think, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse of the difference between men and women, which is that men objectify sexual body parts. We objectify people. We look at, you know, we look at boobs, we look at butts, we look at, and we start to think about sex. And women may look at those same things, but they're thinking more about who is this person.
Mm-hmm.
Women, and that's how your brains are built. I mean, there is a difference between men and women. You know, you can, there's lots of documented research on Mars and Venus. And women will objectify the idea of a person or who they might be to them, and then they feel sexual. In other words, if I were a woman, I'd be thinking, I'm looking at some imagery, or I'm looking at some guys in the street, and I might find them attractive, but I'm also thinking, you know, I wonder if they'd be nice to me. I wonder what kind of conversations we'd have. I wonder if he would be sweet to me when we're making love. You know, there's got to be for healthy women a real sense of connection or relationship in order for her to really enjoy and connect with her sexuality. At least that's been the case in our generation. I think there are younger women who are now more interested in hooking up because they want to satisfy their physical pleasure and they don't necessarily want to get involved. But I do want to pursue this conversation when we return. I know we got to go, about women, the difference between men and women and sex addiction, because I think it's worth another minute or two.
Yeah, just as a question for you to be thinking about. So I'm wondering, in both cases, what drives a woman to get to you, Rob, and say,
right,
I need treatment? What drives a man? Let's talk about that when we come back. You've been listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We're so honored tonight to have with us Rob Weiss, the author of Always Turned On, Sex Addiction in the Digital Age. We'll be right back.
Christine Andrew, president of Cazozo, where we highlight meaningful wellness information in spectacular ways. Recently, I was on a whirlwind adventure in Asia, and my constant companion through four different countries, Tom Matt's book, Maximize Your Quality of Life, the 200% Solution. Anyone familiar with Cazozo knows we work with the best experts and information out there. We believe in quality, and our foundation is built on passion in helping others. That's why the 200% Solution has me as one of its biggest fans. It has information on fitness, nutrition, brain health, supplements, family, and all the things in life that really make our lives worth living. You have to get it, believe me. It's a great read. And you can find it where you can find other high-quality wellness information. Right at our site, www.cazozo.com. C-O-S-O-Z-O.com. Get your copy today and start maximizing the quality of your life.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We're here with Rob Weiss talking about his new book, Always Turned On, Sex Addiction in the Digital Age. Rob, just for our listeners' sake, let's clarify one more time. So how would you define cyber sex addiction?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard. We have to understand. I define it the way I would define all addictions, which means that, you know, most of us enjoy alcohol. We might have a glass of wine after before dinner. We might get drunk on New Year's Eve. But it isn't a pervasive problem in our lives. And if it were, we'd say, oh, that drinking's a problem for me. I don't want to drink anymore. It gives me a headache or whatever it is. But then we also know there's a certain percentage of the population that when they drink, they don't stop drinking and they have all kinds of problems and then they keep drinking anyway. So just like with alcohol, you know, we all enjoy sexuality. Many people enjoy recreational forms of sexuality, not only intimate forms of sexuality. And most of those folks are just out there having a good time. And I say it's none of my business. And I think this is important to say to you, Suzanne, is that sex addiction therapists and my field, we're not the sex police. You know, right. We're not there to say this is good sex and this is bad sex, or you should be with men or you should be with women, or you shouldn't want to put on panties or put down that foot, you know, that fancy shoe. It's not my job. My job is when someone comes to me and says my sexual behavior is becoming so pervasive in my life that that I'm lying to my spouse consistently. I'm spending half my day at work looking at porn. In other words, when my kids come home, I can't wait to get rid of them so I can get online and chat with someone on the computer. When someone's life becomes so when the guiding force of it becomes the pursuit of sex, and notice I don't say having sex, I say the pursuit of it.
Right.
So the three signs of any addiction, really quickly. Number one, preoccupation and obsession, that this becomes a driving force in my life above other priorities like kids, family, dating, mating, work, education. Two, that I'm having consequences related to it, that people are saying, you know, I don't like all this porn you're looking at, or you're not doing so well in school, or how come you seem to not be getting your work done at work, or how come we're not so intimate in our relationship anymore? And I can clearly see it's related to, let's say, my porn use or my cyber sex, and I ignore it. Mm-hmm. And the third sign is that I've lost control. And this is any addiction, and behavioral or substance. I say, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. It's really causing problems. I think I need to slow down or do less of that, whether it's less drinking, less gambling, less porn use, whatever it is. And the person finds that they can't, that even though they said, I'm not going to do this, they find themselves somehow back there again and again and again.
Yes.
And those apply to any highly pleasurable or satiating behavior or substance use.
Right. So that's very, very clear. Now, with that sort of as the backdrop, what differences do you see? I was talking about females that I'd worked with and it being somewhat more relationship tied. What are the differences you've seen with gender, with men and women, with this type of addiction, Rob?
Well, you know, we talked about the different cultural values that we have for men and women who have a lot of sex. But there are other issues, too, and this is kind of how they play out. When a man gets in trouble for sexual behavior, let's say his spouse finds, you know, 1,000 porn images on the computer and finds out he's been hooking up with prostitutes and, you know, she's in a relationship with him, and he's going to say to her, you know what, maybe I have a sex addict, maybe I have a sex problem, maybe I need to go see one of those sex addiction therapists. He will have no problem identifying the problem as being sexual because men objectify. So when men are looking at or exchanging sexual images, sexual experience, they're thinking of it as a very body part. They're thinking about sex. Because women tend to think more relationally, a woman will walk into a therapist and instead of saying, I have a problem with sex addiction or porn addiction or cyber sex, she'll say something like, you know, I seem to be having a problem with men, or am I having a problem with dating, or, you know, I just can't seem to find the right person. I heard you laugh at that, Sue.
Yeah, it's true. That's exactly what they say.
So I can have a guy who's hooking up 3 times a week on some hookup app and spending a couple hours a day looking at porn, and he'll say, I have a sex problem. But I have a woman who's meeting guys 3 days a week from Match.com or Harmony or Tinder and also looking at porn a couple of days a week, and she'll come into therapy and say, I have a problem with relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem is that we don't identify – part of it is we don't identify sexual problems in women nearly as – and we're not as a culture, we're not even as comfortable asking women about their sexual behavior as we are men. And also in our culture, when people get in trouble for sex, it's usually men, like in prison when you look at offending. So we don't think of women as having these problems, but women who have trauma, women who have abuse, women mm-hmm. who have neglect, they do have these problems. Not all of them, but many of them. They just don't see them as being sexual. And one more thing about this, I think you'll find this fascinating, Sue, I do, is that like about 80% of the men who go into treatment for sex addiction, or I should say 80% of the people who go to sex addiction treatment are male, and about 20% are female. But when you look at eating disorders, like food addiction or anorexia, about 80% of the people who go to treatment are female, and about 20% are male. So part of what we're seeing are gender differences between how men and women act out emotional pain. Men will act out with violence, with drugs and alcohol, and with sex. And women will tend to more act out with self-harm, drugs and alcohol, and food. So what happens when a woman comes into a treatment center, if we know what we're doing, she will usually be there for drugs and alcohol or depression or for an eating disorder. And if we are smart enough and we know what we're doing in treatment and we say, hey, let's talk about your sexual life, it's not unusual at all to find out that this woman has been bouncing back and forth between gaining a lot of weight when she's in a relationship, literally pushing her spouse away, and then when out of a relationship, losing all that weight and going out and being hypersexual or having a lot of sex. And she'll bounce back and forth between sex and food for years, not understanding why she can't find a good relationship or stay on a good diet. And it has nothing to do with either one. She's just running what we call co-occurring or two addictions at the same time.
It rings very true. It really does ring true. It's such a desperate attempt to feel okay, to deal with, as you say, the early scars of trauma, the depression, the self-loathing, and how it comes out. You know, we look for what we find what we look for. So you really offer our listeners a very important clue that very often, much as we miss men's depression because they're so angry and they're doing road rage, etc., you're suggesting we miss women's sexual addiction because we're busy looking at the compulsive eating, the compulsive shopping, etc. It's a great...
And I would add to that, Sue, just as therapists, you know, a lot of people come in with sexual trauma, as sadly, and women in particular, not that we don't have lots of male trauma survivors, but people often who work with trauma don't think to ask, so what is your sexual life like today? They get very focused on the fact that someone was molested or harmed or raped, and they see that as the cause of their problems as an adult, and they may well be the cause of their adult problems. But going into and working on the past doesn't resolve the present. You have to look at the present and address the present, and then you can go back and look at address the past if you have an addiction. Because people with addictions, they're so constantly creating crises and shame for themselves that they really can't adequately look back at early trauma. They have to stop their adult behavior.
And, you know, one of the things I always say because of the trauma work I do is that when there hasn't been the opportunity to work on the early scars, trauma outs itself in one way or another. These are the type of ways that it outs itself. And it just leads to more pain. We talk so much about men and women and men with men, women with women. Let's talk about partners for a minute, because let's talk about when a woman comes in and says, he's hooked to porn. He doesn't look at me anymore. I mean, how could I compete with what he's dealing with? Is it me? I think it is my fault. I don't look like the women online. And the men have been unbelievably devastated. They feel tremendous shame when they find out there's been hookups online. Again, Rob, it's much as what you're saying. She's replacing me with someone. She's talking. She's video chatting with someone. She's sexting a neighbor. So that there's so much pain, actually, when the partner does find out what's going on. Let's talk a little bit about the partner in the relationship fallout from cyber sex and sex addiction.
Well, I think, you know, just in the most general way, infidelity, we have to look at a different way of a different name. We need a different definition for infidelity than we had pre-digital age, because pre-digital age, infidelity, Sue, was when Susan, you and me, I mean, we were working together. We were having an in-office affair. I went home with lipstick on my collar. I had perfume. You know, I stayed late at work. We were always in the copy room with the door closed. I knew what infidelity looked like pre-digital age, because it was two people who were involved in a real-time, real-life interaction in some way. But what is infidelity now when I'm sitting in the den, let's say, looking at porn or web chatting with somebody about sex, and my spouse is in, male or female, is in the den saying, honey, when are you coming in to watch TV? And I say, I'll be in a few minutes. I'm really just finishing up the taxes. You know, at what point am I really cheating? And, you know, is looking at images cheating? Because I have a lot of guys who'll say to their spouses, hey, listen, you know, my dad looked at Playboy. I look at this. What's the big deal? You know, I have women who will chat with old boyfriends from college or high school on Facebook, and they'll say to their husband, look, I'm just staying in touch with an old friend. So, you know, when does it become really infidelity? And I define infidelity in the digital age as the keeping of secrets in an intimate relationship.
I agree. I do agree with you. Mm-hmm.
So, Sue, you know, if we're married and we're in a relationship and you like to look at a lot of porn and you masturbate a couple of times a week and I don't know anything about that, and one day I go in to see my sweet partner's computer and I find all this porn on it, I'm probably going to be horrified.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, and why am I going to be horrified? Mostly because it's a shock because I didn't know what was going on. If, however, we're in a relationship and I said, you know, once in a while I look at porn and, you know, if you get on my computer, you might run into it. And you say, okay, hey, everybody masturbates, no big deal, and you don't see it affecting our relationship, then no harm, no foul, you know, because you're going to go to the computer, you might find some porn, and you say, oh, yeah, that's the stuff he's looking at, you know, but it's not going to be the devastation. So first of all, you know, we have to define infidelity as really keeping secrets, because today there are couples with open marriages, there are couples who have, and there have always been. It's the surprise. It's the, I thought I knew you. I thought I knew everything about you. Or how could you do this to me? I thought you loved me. And the thought, especially that female spouses will have, which is that if you're lying about this, maybe you're lying about everything. And in fact, maybe everything we've ever had together is a lie. So betrayal is a really profound trauma to a spouse when they have had no clue that the person was involved in any way with anything else. Oh, and by the way, Sue, I hate the term, why didn't the wife know? They should have known. Everybody else knew. That's so unfair.
I agree. We even have research that suggests when you love someone and you're connected with them,
right,
cognitively, you're not going to see something disparate with what you feel about the person.
No, if you think someone has your back and they love you, the last thing you're going to think is they're out there doing the thing that they already know would most hurt you.
Right.
So the person who finds out that that's actually going on is pretty devastated. So first of all, I think it's really not a choice today for couples to be dishonest with each other about their sexuality. And I'm actually working on a book about integrity around sex and intimacy. And the idea for me is that, you know, I think that people have not been willing to tell their truth.
Okay, we're just about going to take a break. We're going to come right back. You've been listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We're here with Rob Weiss. He's talking about always turned on sex addiction in the digital age. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We're talking about sex addiction in the digital age. Rob, we've really laid out some of the pain and some of certainly the characteristics of cyber sex addiction. So I'm imagining people are thinking, oh my God, what a mountain this must be to climb to get out of this. And I wonder, can you give us somewhat of a glimpse at what would treatment look like? What are the rough spots? Where does the partner fit in? You know, what are we talking about? I know you talk about accountability partners. How do we approach treatment?
Well, a couple of basics about treatment of any addiction. Number one, it can't be taken alone. So if you can fix your addiction on yourself, you're not an addict. The whole idea of being an addict is part of the main underlying philosophies of addiction is that it's something that the person can't control on their own. So, there are certainly therapists for various addictions, and they all have specialties, whether it's alcohol and drugs or gaming or gambling or sex. And I would make sure if you were seeking out someone for an addiction, find a specialist in that area, because I can tell you I know lots about drugs and alcohol, but if you wanted to see me, you really should see me about sex addiction or porn problems or cyber sex. You know, and by the way, I know a little bit about eating disorders, but you really need – so believe it or not, just like you need to see someone for a bone problem or a skin problem, you need to see someone for the specific addiction you're dealing with. And what that person's going to do is, number one, they're really going to try to break through some of your – thinking, kind of make you look at what you've been doing a different way. And I want to take an example, Sue, that you mentioned before. It was the example of a spouse saying, you know, oh, you know, I can't compete with those images and we don't make love anymore and you're not being intimate and you're distant and, you know, I'm never going to be the age of those people in those images you're looking at in the porn, and what is a partner supposed to do? And I think, you know, in that scenario, you know, there's some – if the partner, if the husband – if it's a husband, says, well, hey, I'm just doing what other guys do. They look at porn. I look at porn. My dad looked at Playboy. That's denial. And the reason it's denial is because here's a man sitting there with his spouse in pain, unhappy about something he's doing. And it doesn't really matter to me about the sex. Why isn't he paying attention to what she's saying? If she's saying, this bothers me, I'm upset about it, I feel left out, we're not making love, I feel distant from you, why is the porn so important? Why can't he just say, hey, you know what? Let me put this down for a while till we figure this out, and then we'll see if we can work it in again. Or, you know, why, if his move is, and it's not always a man, but if his move is to protect the porn over the relationship,
right?
That's a problem. And that's a relationship problem. He may or may not have a porn problem, but why isn't he paying attention to the emotions that are being brought up by the spouse? So I think that's really, you know, a big piece of it.
And you can see a real vicious cycle in that, because if we think that partners are best sexually when they feel safe and desired and understood, the woman who's told, no big deal, you've got to understand this, in this case, the woman has not been listened to. So how could she possibly feel safe and safe enough to be intimate with this man?
Right. So you already know you have a problem when a spouse is being dismissed or their concerns are being dismissed, regardless of whether there's an addiction present or not.
Right.
And you had some other questions you wanted to ask. I don't know.
Well, the other thing that I think it's worth saying is, you know, if I'm addicted to cocaine and I just stay away from the neighborhood persons, places and things where I got cocaine, that's one thing. But if I'm addicted to cyber sex and anything connected with internet computers, and I work in an office with computers, I mean, how on earth do I ever achieve sobriety? How do I ever deal with abstinence? I mean, what do those terms even mean?
I think that, you know, this is a point people really struggle with, and it's so simple really to think about, is that if you have a drug or an alcohol problem, or let's say a gambling problem, you can never drink again. You can never do mood-altering drugs again. You can never go to a casino again and have a perfectly happy life. So abstinence from drugs, alcohol, or gambling or gaming is sobriety for people with those issues. But what do you deal with? How do you deal with an eating, a food addiction, or a sex addiction, where the person, where it's a naturally occurring function? Obviously, you need to eat. That's healthy. Being sexual is healthy. How do we help somebody not binge eat or not binge sex, if you will? And I think that you know, the way the field looks at this, the way the addiction field looks at this, is that we make contracts with people. We literally sit down and say, you know, I'll say to you, Sue, you know, you said that you wanted to save your marriage, or you said you wanted to start dating in a healthy way, or you say you want to connect with your kids more, but you're so distracted by or having problems with porn or your ex-boyfriend or whatever it is. We're going to contract, you and me, on a piece of paper. We're going to sign an agreement that the things that are working against your goals in life around your sexual behavior are going to be things that you're going to eliminate. We're also going to look at what is healthy sexuality for you and what kinds of sexuality lead you toward health, healing, intimacy, and the things you say you want. And then we're going to both sign that agreement. And as long as you – and we, by the way, we do the same thing with eating disorders. People who binge eat have certain limitations around sugar or second helpings or going to buffets, or and all of that is written up and contracted. And as long as the person follows their contract, they're sober. And they're also very consciously not doing things that they already know would only escalate the problem that they've been having. And that's how we work with sobriety.
Now, I know we all know about sponsors in AA, et cetera. Now, you call the sponsor in your program an accountability partner, which different than the spouse.
Well, I think that not everyone knows the term sponsor. Sponsors in the 12-step program is kind of just somebody who's a little bit further along than you. Mm-hmm. They've had some more sobriety. They've been around longer. They know the ropes. So in essence, any sponsor is an accountability partner, because they're the person you turn to when you're struggling. the reason I use that term in the book is because not everyone's going to go to a 12-step program. Mm-hmm. Some people are going to go to faith-based groups. Some people are going to go to online groups that help with porn problems. Some people are going to go to a therapist. So the idea, as I said earlier, is that people who are addicts don't recover from addiction by themselves. If they could, they would. So there really needs to be someone in your life that you trust, that you know, who understands the problem, who understands what you've agreed to change and your commitments, who you're checking in with on a regular basis and getting support from. And you're right, it shouldn't be a spouse, because these issues are too close to the heart for a spouse. And, you know, I want to turn to an accountability partner and say, you know, I was at work today and I clicked on a couple of porn sites and I realized, what was I doing? And I just clicked off them immediately and now I'm calling you. Right. My sponsor will say, good for you. I'm really great job. If I called my wife or husband and said, hey, I clicked on a little bit of porn today, I don't think the reaction would be quite as right. You know, what I'm struggling with. So it has to be someone who's neutral and supportive, who understands the goals. And most of all, and this is the most important thing, especially for sex addicts, is sex addicts need to not have any secrets. It's not that their spouse needs to know everything, as you said. You know, I'm not going to say to my spouse every time I see someone cute on the street. But someone needs to know, meaning if you're a sex addict, that you were struggling today. It doesn't have to be your spouse, but someone needs to know.
Yeah, and the honesty thing is a very big thing with restoring the bond with the partner.
And it changes your brain. Mm-hmm. You know, literally, your brain changes. If you are honest long enough and you get uncomfortable with being dishonest, which is what they really preach in 12-step recovery and all those meetings, you know, and if you see dishonesty as having led you down the path of ending up where you didn't want to be, then dishonesty hopefully becomes uncomfortable. And that's what we want.
The other thing that I agree with that you support is very important is for the partner to get help. For the partner to have a support network, for the partner to be able to really heal from this trauma, put words to what they've been through, look at some of the self-blame, some of the judgment, where the marriage was before. There's loads of pieces to this that the partner really can have the benefit of if they're in some sort of support or treatment themselves.
Well, I would say that every couple I've ever met has a 50% better shot of working things out if both partners are working on the issues together, or at least, or maybe more. But you'd probably say 80%. But I'm being conservative.
Exactly right. I have heard a similar thing. You know, we're just about out of time. We're going to take a brief break. You've been listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Psych Up on Cazozo Radio. We're here with Rob Weitz talking about his book, Always Turned On, Sex Addiction in the Digital Age. Rob, you've shared so much about this today, so many wonderful and important ideas. I know our listeners are going to want to read this book and other books, connect with you, send you questions. How can they reach you? How can they get to your material?
Thanks, Suzanne. And I just want to say, like, I'm not very good with answering phones, but I do always answer emails, even if it's 3 a.m. and somebody writes me. If they're in trouble or they're struggling, I'm gonna answer the phone. In fact, my phone's ringing, and that might be someone right now. There are a couple of websites I'd recommend. One of them is, I'll recommend my website because it's robertweissmsw.com, robertweissmsw.com. The reason I mention it is because every article, every blog, every book, every therapy, you know, I've tried to put everything I can up there about porn and sex problems, especially related to the digital world, because, you know, people are embarrassed. They don't know where to turn for resources, and they can go on my site and find them. Sexualrecovery.com is another really terrific site, sexualrecovery.com. And also Dr. Patrick Carnes has a site called sexhelp.com, and I would think any of those would be really useful. Also, in a general way, there's a wonderful site on addiction called addiction.com. Couldn't be easier. And it covers all of the addictions from gambling to gaming to sex to heroin. And addiction.com is a great place to gather information, and you'll get the help you need.
And your new book, which is terrific, Always Turned On, is available on Amazon. I know that's where I got it, as well as all your other books are on Amazon, right?
Yeah, I've written a lot, quite a bit about things like parenting in the digital age. And, you know, it's not, I don't just write about sex addiction. I'm very interested and curious about, you know, this digital divide we're experiencing between older folks, meaning over 35, and younger folks who are, we're really living in two different worlds. And so I'm very interested in what I would call the generation gap. And I think we're having one right now. And so I wrote a book called Closer Together, Further Apart, trying to help parents understand what their kids are going through and how to handle it. And that came out last year.
Yep, we did a great show on that. So let's go right to that. Rob, let's talk about cyber sex and young people in terms of with what I've seen is, I can't tell you how many mothers have said, oh, my God, my daughter's sexting, or the whole question of young men being, you know, locked in rooms with video games and never wanting to come out again, and what are we doing to young people? What about this problem in relation to young adults or teens?
Well, I think in general, you know, my biggest message, I think in general that what we're experiencing is another turn of our human evolutionary wheel. And I remember when my parents said that sex, drugs, and rock and roll was going to ruin my generation. I'm 53, so I'm a boomer. And I remember what they said about, you know, the drugs we took, the music we listened to, and the fact that women were having sex without looking for pregnancy and marriage, you know, because you got the pill. And so, you know, the last turn of the technological wheel, which was, you know, in terms of sex, women having the ability to not become pregnant, really pushed forward the sexual revolution for women and in general. Well, now we're seeing a new technological, new technologies evolving that are driving our sense of connection and mating and dating. You know, kids can look at porn. I was playing Spin the Bottle. My parents had to go to double dates. You know, I mean, we are experiencing evolution in our culture's relationship to sexuality. Look at Jennifer Lawrence, by the way, that lovely young woman from The Hunger Games who got, you know, berated in the press because her nude pictures on her phone were put up online last summer. And people said, oh, my God, why would a beautiful, smart young woman have nude pictures on her phone? Well, let me tell you, you know, 30% of kids between 18 and 25 have nude pictures on their phone. It is becoming a cultural norm.
Okay, so let me ask real quick, Rob. So if I'm a parent, beyond the norm, how do I know if my son or my daughter is not someone who's vulnerable not only to try a drug but to get hooked?
Well, it's the same as it's always been, right? I mean, if you see your kids' functionality, if they're not doing as well in school, if they seem more depressed and isolating, if they're not hanging out in school activities, if they're isolating, you know, and of course I understand that every kid spends that the average is 11 hours on digital media for a teenager day.
Right.
So every kid looks like they're isolating. But I think you can tell by mood whether a kid is losing themselves in something and disappearing into some activity or drug, or whether they're still an active part of the family. Because, you know, just because they're a teenager, you can still pretty much tell a happy kid from an unhappy kid. I think a parent's greatest concern with life online is not talking to them about it. Sex education is being given. Every kid in America is getting sex education today. It's coming via the pornographers. And if you want your children to have appropriate and useful sex education that involves intimacy and relationship, the only people that are going to teach that are parents.
That's a great point. Thanks so much, Rob Weiss. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Best with this new book, Always Turned On, Sex Addiction in the Digital Age.
Thanks again. It's always a pleasure. I love being on your show.
Thanks so much. Thanks to our producer, Corinne Johnston. And thanks to the listeners out there. You know, you can always reach me at psychup@cazozo.com. We'll be back next week with another show. Please be listening.
The contents of this site and program are for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing found on our website is intended to be a substitute for professional psychological, psychiatric, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.